I'm an alcoholic. My name is Doug. And supposed to tell you what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And sort of like Howard last night, I used to be a self-loathing drunk. I took the steps, and today I'm self-respecting and sober. And that's it. That's the story. January 29th, 1949, a doctor severed the umbilical cord connecting me to my prenatal environment, and I began 13 years of sterling sobriety. Then I had a slip. I was standing in the parking lot of a bowling alley with about three other misfits, and we were passing around a jug of warm red wine, and I had a spiritual awakening. I had gone to that bowling alley an inadequate, self-conscious, pimple-faced, four-eyed virgin, and I got that warm red wine to the pit of my stomach, and it went to the top of my head, and I became cute and smart and sexy and witty and competent and adequate and 10 feet tall and bulletproof. And besides that, hell, I could bowl. And I think I spent the rest of my drinking career trying to regain that plateau of spiritual wellness that I experienced on my first drunk. And I'm here today to report that I never got quite all the way back to where I wanted to be. But I got close enough to keep trying. And the nature of my disease is that there was something about a can of Schlitz that would erase the memory of the last can of Schlitz just enough to make the next can of Schlitz seem like the best idea in the whole world. Normal people apparently don't drink that way, and I've known some of them, you know, and I find them real entertaining. A doctor told me one time that alcohol is a central nervous system depressant chemically classified as a sedative, and that means it should relax you. And according to all we know about brain chemistry and alcohol and the effect it has on the human body and all this, it's a sedative. Now, caffeine, I'll get to nicotine if I decide I'm gonna. By the way, I got to make a policy statement here. I forgot to do some of my little house cleaning before beginning this talk. I'm a dogmatic, recovered alcoholic, and I am absolutely opposed to the use of all mind-changing substances except for those I am still using. And there are four commonly and legally ingested in the United States: caffeine, nicotine, sugar, and alcohol. And 7,184 days after my last drink, I still run on 3 out of 4. So that ought to give you a little wellness index, you know. But on the other hand, I thank you for mentioning the non-smoking section. There's a chair way back there in the corner that is reserved for the caffeine-free, nicotine-free, sugar-free, sexually abstinent vegetarian. You know, but I won't be there for a while, I don't think, you know. I never know about things like that. I got an old sponsor in Houston who refused to chair a non-smoking meeting and said, well, we got to have them all for, you know, newcomers can't give it all up at once. I don't think AA meetings ought to be non-smoking because it's too hard on newcomers. He had a heart attack and quit, and now he says, I think meetings ought to be non-smoking so old-timers can go to them. I don't believe he's aware that there was a change of policy anywhere along the way. See, because he's like I am. He's unalterably opposed to the use of all mind-changing substances except those he's still using. So I go over to his house and drink coffee in his non-smoking environment. See, but neither one of us has had a drink of alcohol in a long time. Ain't that a damn strange thing for two alcoholics? Anyway, I got to this fellowship And the good news is I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. The bad news is I have had no experience in sobriety that approximates a good drunk. Trouble with that is I hadn't had a good drunk for at least 10 years before I got to AA. My good drunks were over. And I hadn't been to an AA meeting yet that'll make me feel like $2 is enough to go to Mexico and actually do it. You know. But I watch normal people, and I know that alcohol has a sedative effect on them, and then I see drunks, you know, and we bring them in here, and they've been bathing their brain in this general sedative for a period of years, and we switch them to coffee. Now, there's something about that that is counterindicated. You take somebody who's been on sedatives for 30 years, put them on a stimulant overnight, and a doctor would tell you you're going to have to peel them off of the ceiling. Well, we bring them in here, we say, you ready to quit drinking? Yeah. Well, go over there and get you a cup of coffee. And we switch them from a sedative to a stimulant, and it takes. You know, the next thing you know, they don't drink anymore except 35 cups of coffee. And then they go home and have a cup of coffee to go to sleep. How's that work? My answer, and it's only a personal answer, and I don't have any idea, it's a medical mystery to me how this works, but I take alcohol into my system, and I experience that sedative as a stimulant. And I know that normal people don't do that, because I've known some. As a matter of fact, I married one. And my first wife used to have two drinks and get kind of relaxed. You know, I had two drinks, and I might get kind of relaxed, but after the third drink, I was looking for action. And my father completely baffled me at his reaction to alcohol. He drank heavily, but not excessively most of his life, and one day a doctor told him to quit. And he went home and closed the louvered doors on his cute little wet bar and said, well, I have to stop drinking. Never took another drink on medical advice. And, you know, I'd have had to go home and have a drink to think about dying. And then I'd have had to have a drink to think about not drinking. And the more I thought about not drinking, the more I'd have to drink to deal with the fact that I had to quit drinking. Because that's the way my disease worked, you know. There was something about a drink that made any situation tolerable until I got to you people in January 1976. And I had finally gone and done something I wouldn't have gone and done if I'd known how drunk I was when I went and did it. And what complicated that was, it was unnecessary that I do so. I had been licensed by the state of Texas to practice law before any court of that supreme jurisdiction, and that ought to tell you more about the standards of the state of Texas than about any other operative fact. And I had gone into a municipal court in a blackout and came out of that blackout looking at a criminal complaint. And the situation was such that I could have called down there and told them, I can't come tonight, hell, I'm too drunk. And they would have thought it was funny, and they would have told my client that his attorney was indisposed. And they would have reset that ticket and told him to come back in 2 weeks. But, you know, I went down there. And I came out of this blackout looking at a criminal complaint, and the good news is I'm not the defendant. But the bad news is I'm not sure who is. And the prosecutor in this case was a fellow named Herb G. He's not anonymous, he's Chinese. And Herb G. said, Doug, you're drunk. And Doug D. said, no kidding, or words to that effect. And Herb G. said, I'll dismiss this case on one condition. And Doug D. said, you got it, what is it? And Herb G. said, you have your client drive you home. So I don't know how you began to understand that your life was unmanageable, but one of my first hints was that the sovereign authority of the state of Texas thought that some screwball who was accused of speeding through a school zone was more to be trusted with a motor vehicle than I was. And we had to go out in the hallway and wait for the prosecutor to check with hit and run and make sure I hadn't killed anybody on my way to the courthouse. And I used that time to explain to my client that speeding tickets are often dismissed due to the intoxication of counsel. And, you know, the neat thing about that is he believed it. So I went back to my office. I wasn't going to go home because my wife lived there. And I didn't want to see her. And I took reasonable steps to... first of all, I alerted my landlord, who was a non-drinking Methodist layman, that I needed a drink. And he called the doctor. And he said, I have a drunk on my hands and he wants a drink. Should I give him one? And the doctor said, is he violent? And my landlord said, at the moment he's throwing furniture about his office and I'm afraid he's going to damage my property. And the doctor said, by all means, give him a drink. If you're lucky, the son of a bitch will pass out. So my landlord went next door to the beer joint and got me my last drink. And it was a can of Michelob, and I was a Schlitz drinker, and if I'd have known it was going to be my last drink, I would have refused it. But I was in a situation where I had to do something about my drinking, and I didn't want to come to AA because the only thing I knew about you was that you couldn't drink, and I honestly hoped I never got that bad. So I made a mistake. It's only a mistake in retrospect. I called my pastor. And I thought we'd go out to the pastor's home and we'd have a word of prayer and I would have a charismatic experience from which I would emerge a normal social drinker. And I got double-crossed by a man of the cloth because he turned me over to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that wasn't what I bargained for. You see, I was seeking a spiritual solution, but I was looking for the wrong miracle. I wanted to be transformed into something I never was, which was a normal social drinker. And I had no idea that recovery was possible, and I had no idea that part of the deal was for me to take some responsibility for my own recovery. What I was looking for was quick and easy. And when I described that first drunk to you, I described something that I believe to be today, that I've come to believe, is the fundamental nature of the disease, and that is that alcoholism, at least my alcoholism, is a hunger for a spiritual experience. And it's a hunger for a spiritual experience which I attempt to feed with the junk food of addiction. And that ought to resolve some of this dispute between addicts and alcoholics. As far as I'm concerned, I'm an alcoholic not because alcohol is my drug of choice, but because drugs are my choice as a path to spirituality. And it explained so much of my behavior that I didn't otherwise understand. I kept shopping churches and never found the right one, you know. I figured if I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and they were just too liberal, you know. Maybe if I got a real church, I'd get good and sober. And what happens if you baptize me is all you get is a wet drunk, you know. And I was seeking a spiritual experience and trying what I was doing basically in seeking a spiritual experience is accepting a pretty good counterfeit. Intoxication, for me, is an excellent counterfeit of spirituality. And never having seen the real thing, I had no way of distinguishing the counterfeit from the reality. And the counterfeit seemed to be the currency of the realm. And for me, the counterfeit was the currency of the realm, and I was the king, and I made it my currency. And it was the means by which I was able to deal with life. It was the means by which I was able to achieve a feeling of well-being. It was the means by which I was able to achieve a sense of self-esteem. And I didn't know that it was junk food for a spiritual hunger. I didn't know that it was a counterfeit of a spiritual experience. I didn't know that anything else was available. And it seemed like all those things I sought to fill that hole within me, that feeling of inadequacy and incompetency that still in sobriety sometimes returns. I didn't know that all of those things I sought to make me feel whole were junk food. I didn't know that all of those things I sought to make me feel whole were a substitute for the real thing, and I didn't know that the real thing was available until I got to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and started to take some of the action that's suggested in the 12 steps. And that I got as a result of the humility of a long-suffering, hard-working pastor in Houston, Texas, who knew that I was a drunk and he could not provide an adequate solution for my particular situation. And I've come to admire and respect him for that. I got over all my resentments. But he was on my list for a long time. And what I guess I'm trying to say is that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had an awareness of a spiritual realm, and I didn't have a visa to get into it. And I had attempted to use alcohol as a passport, and I'd come close. But I had not landed in the real place, and I was looking for a way to land in the real place. And what I was attempting to do, I thought, was religion. What I was attempting to do, I thought, was spirituality. What I was attempting to do, I thought, had something to do with getting from here to there. It turns out what I was engaged in was more magic and superstition than religion and spirituality. And alcohol was magic, and my whole belief system was superstition. Did you ever think about isms? What is an ism? And I thought about, well, let's see, we got communism, fascism, Buddhism, Judaism, Methodism, alcoholism. What the hell is an ism? An ism is a belief system that defines and governs all thought and action for the person subscribing to the ism. And then my sponsor thought that wasn't quite such a smart answer. He said, what about botulism? And I said, well, in Christian Science, botulism would be the belief that an amoeba is eating your ass for lunch. And but what I've discovered is that my problem is not alcohol. My problem is alcoholism, and alcohol is the drug I prescribed for my alcoholism, and that stuff worked like magic because it was magic. And my alcoholism was the system of superstition that my sick mind devised to support and uphold the magic. And my alcoholism is still today, if I don't take appropriate action, my habitual and preferred system of thinking. And I discovered a lot of wisdom in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When they talk about prayer and meditation in the 11th step, and I'm not there yet, but neither are you probably, but that's all right too. If you're new and you got by, I'm going to say some things that are only my opinion, and you can't prove them by the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to accept them. And I know some of you people are going to get this tape because you want to play it for your sponsor. But don't wait until you've done the first nine to get into 10, 11, and 12, because if you wait until you've done the first nine to get into 10, 11, and 12, you might not stay sober long enough to do the first nine. And if you're not going to pray until you take an inventory, you might not pray until after you start drinking. You know, it's just that simple. For me, the 11th step is a step you can start using from your first day of sobriety. Make some kind of conscious contact with some kind of higher power. Use the 10th step. Take your emotional temperature. It might take you about 72 hours to figure out you got feelings, but once you know you got feelings, don't wait until you've done a 4th step before you start a 10th step. Because you might not stay sober long enough to do a 4th step if you don't start doing a 10th step. It's not difficult to give yourself an emotional sort of gut check, you know, am I angry? You know, and the answer is, hell no. Well, you're angry. You know, better find that out. You better find that out because of a principle I learned going to meetings in the United Kingdom. A friend of mine had gone to the United Kingdom, and his secretary told people he had gone to the United Kingdom, and one of them sent flowers. But I went to some meetings in the mother country, which for me is England. I notice a lot of Spanish and French flags here around Natchez, but je suis anglais and all that. And I kept hearing people in these meetings talk about getting pissed. And I'm from Texas. Now, in Texas, when we get pissed, we're angry. In Her Majesty's dominions, when they get pissed, they're drunk. And it didn't take me long to find out I didn't want to tell those Englishmen I was pissed. And what I found out as a result of that experience is that there's a correlation between those two conditions, see, because if I stay Texas pissed long enough, I'm fixing to get properly British pissed soon enough. And that's one of the reasons for the 10th step. I just interrupted myself. Randy from Columbia, Louisiana, are you here tonight? Yeah. I saw Randy earlier today, and Charlie told me I was going to be speaking directly to him. And when I went back to my room to make my arrangements to get spiritually prepared to tell my story, I said, God, I'm supposed to have a message for Randy from Columbia, Louisiana. And God said, who? Yeah, I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got in the craziest outfit in the world as far as I was concerned. Nothing you said made any sense, and everything you said seemed to be working. And I couldn't understand how it works, and I got a sponsor, and he said, get into the book and take the steps. And I couldn't see what that had to do with anything. And so I made a game plan. They said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, and I had a desire to stop drinking for 30 days. And during that 30 days, I came up with a better idea. I'll stop for 6 months and get out of debt. And during that 6 months, I came up with a better idea. Maybe I ought to quit one day at a time. And the reason I made that decision is simple. I got to you people fairly young and fairly healthy. And I kept hearing you say that recovery was a matter of life and death. And that didn't make sense to me until I started hearing people's stories. And they would talk about driving in a blackout, and I'd think, yeah, I did that. And then they'd talk about suicide attempts, and I'd think, yeah, I did that. The only thing that kept me from attempting suicide in a serious fashion was fear of failure. All my fantasies ended in failure. The overdose would end up with a stomach pump in the hospital. And the bullet trip was like, what if I end up blind but not quite dead? I thought about jumping out of a building, but I had visions of ending up in a wheelchair depending on my ever-loving Al-Anon ex-wife to bring me my beer. So for fear of failure, failed to try to do the first thing I probably would have done right, which is kill myself. And when I came to AA and heard you people talking about suicide, and every once in a while somebody would do it right. And then I heard people talking about some of my behaviors, picking fights with people who carry knives. And it dawned on me that the chances were excellent that if I kept drinking, I was going to be a homicide, suicide, or accidental death years before I had the bloated liver. The probability of me being lucky enough and healthy enough to live long enough to die in a gutter on Skid Row somewhere was very slim. I mean, it was only the tough that survived to be alcoholics. And the rest of us got eliminated before the diagnosis, you know. And so when sobriety became a matter of life and death, then I got serious about the recovery. And when I got serious about the recovery, I got into these steps, because that was what you all suggested as a method of recovery. And none of them made any sense to me in the beginning, and some still don't. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. To me today, to admit that I'm powerless over alcohol is simply to tell you that my body cannot tolerate it. That's the physical aspect of my disease. If I take a drink, I experience a chemical change which processes that stimulant or that sedative as a stimulant and makes another drink absolutely necessary to attempt to regain that feeling of wellness that I had on my first drunk and never quite got back to. Now, some of y'all are thinking, well, you didn't take the right drugs. Well, I tried them. I don't call myself an alcoholic and an addict because, in my opinion, I'm not an addict, I'm an alcoholic. But unlike the President of the United States, yes, my friends, I inhaled. I tried everything that held out, even the illusion that it would make me feel okay right now. And didn't find anything that made me feel okay right now except for beverage alcohol, which I processed in copious quantities. And it never quite got me back there. But my notion of powerlessness over alcohol is simply this. I was powerless over the idea of a drink. If I had the idea, I eventually took the drink. Might be today, might be tomorrow, might be the end of the week. But if I had the idea, the drink became inevitable. And that helped me to understand how a living, breathing, thinking, sentient being can be powerless over a simple chemical that just sits on a shelf waiting for something to happen to it, like an earthquake or a hurricane or an alcoholic. because if I had the idea, I took the drink. And it suggested that my life was unmanageable, and I didn't entirely understand that either, because I had gone to great lengths to put up a front that other people would look at and say I was doing well. My credit rating was good. My life looked to all outside appearances as if I had it together. But my life was unmanageable in the sense that you can break the word down into its constituent syllables and it comes out unman-age-able. I was emotionally immature. And that emotional immaturity, that unman-age ability that made living in the real world impossible for me was part of the syndrome, part of the superstition that supported the magic that made the first drink unavoidable if I had but the thought of a drink. The miracle of my recovery today is not that I don't think about drinking, because I think about drinking. The miracle of my recovery today is that I can not drink even when I'm thinking about drinking. See, I never had a problem not drinking when I wasn't thinking about it. I had a problem not drinking when I was thinking about it. And today I don't have a problem not drinking when I'm thinking. And that seems to have something to do with step two, which suggested that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Make a long story short with this higher power thing. My higher power, as I conceive of it today in the simplest possible terms, is that this book says, and this is the big book, by the way. This happens to be a study edition that has two little ribbons that you can mark places with and everything. I was telling Charlie I had a big book that looked like Jimmy Swaggart's personal Bible, and I promised to bring it in tonight. Now, this is it, and sometimes I read it. Somewhere in there it says, if we're planning to stop drinking, page 33, if we're planning to stop drinking, there should be no hesitation of any kind or any mental reservation or lurking notion, that someday we'll be immune to alcohol. And I got to asking myself silly questions like, if I got lurking notions, and they're lurking by definition, then how do I know I got them? And the answer is, I don't. Now, I tend to think of my alcoholism as being a little nest of roach eggs on one side of my brain. And every once in a while, one of them hatches. And on his back in bright day glow colors is the word drink. And he'll start making his way across the frontal lobe. You know. And I'm convinced that if one of those bastards ever makes it all the way across, I'll pick up a drink. And my higher power seems to be a cosmic foot that comes down about halfway across the frontal lobe, you know. Which also explains to me why my sober reality sometimes feels like I just got kicked in the head. You know, sometimes maybe I did. But I'll never know how many of those lurking notions got stomped out in the process. Talking about these miracle stories that relate to our thinking, I remember we're talking about Howard's story last night, and that day he planned to drink one beer, and he went all the way to night, you know, and he went from one beer to a case and then a fifth to go with that and all that, and trucks kept getting his way. For those of you that weren't here last night, liquor stores were closed, bosses called him on the carpet, the grocery store across the street got robbed, you know, and his exit for the liquor store was blocked by an 18-wheeler, and he got home, put his beer in the freezer, and the damn things popped in the freezer before he got back to him. And, you know, he was thinking about drinking all day, just didn't take a drink. And I remember when I was 90 days sober, I'd gone to New Orleans, and any of you been down to New Orleans know that in the French Quarter in New Orleans, there's three bars and a strip joint on every block, and then in between bars they got great big old garbage cans full of ice and Dixie. And if you want a drink in New Orleans, you got no problem. All you need is 50 cents. And I was staying in the French Quarter, 90 days sober, walking back and forth down in there and in front of those garbage cans and everything. Had reservations for dinner at a nice restaurant on the West Bank called the Chapultepec Plantation. And on my way out of town, on 90, on my way towards the Huey P. Long Bridge, I said to my long-suffering ex-wife, you know, I believe I'm making too big a deal out of this alcoholism. I think if I wanted to, I could take a drink. And she said in her calm, undisturbed Al-Anon manner, well, 90 days ago you were pretty goddamn sure you were an alcoholic. And by the time we got to the restaurant, I had changed my mind about the desirability of taking that drink. And the point of that story is that I still had the insane thought, but I was allowed to have it under safe circumstances. If I'd had the same thought 1 hour before, I would have reached into one of those garbage cans and bought me a beer. If I'd have had the thought 1 hour later, I'd have called the waiter over and ordered a Manhattan cocktail. But I had the thought in heavy traffic on my way out of town, in the company of a person who brought me back to reality, and I had time to process that information before I got to the restaurant. So I'm convinced today when I say that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, that what I really mean by that is that a power greater than myself can protect me from insane behavior. I believe that only I can protect me from insane thinking. And the good news is they don't put you in, they don't lock you up for thinking. They lock you up for acting out what you're thinking, Nobody's ever been locked up for thinking about suicide. You get locked up for attempting it. And nobody's ever been locked up for thinking about robbing a bank. You get locked up for attempting it. Nobody's ever died drunk from thinking about Schlitz. I'd like to die drunk if I ever pick it up again. And when you get down to these steps of drunk traps in this process, for those of us who are educated beyond our abilities and attempting half measures. And so I've decided I'm powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable, and I got this higher power, a cosmic foot that'll stomp out my insane thoughts, and it suggests that I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And in step three, I made a decision, and I said, well, what's my will and what's my life? And but the answer to those questions is why it's important to have a God of your own understanding before you take the third step. My will is what I want, and my life is what I get. And I'm getting ready to turn my wants and my gets over to a something or somebody, and it better be somebody I trust, or I'm simply not going to be willing to make that decision. And so when I decided, I read the chapter We Agnostics, and at the very end of that chapter is a story about a guy who thought he was an atheist, and he had a sudden and overwhelming experience, what he called the presence of God, and he went on to say that he felt himself in the presence of infinite power and love. And that's about as simple as I can get my understanding of a higher power, is that it's infinite, which means unlimited, power and love. And so there's absolutely no fear and no risk in making a decision to turn what I want and what I get over to the care of unlimited power, which is able to enforce unlimited love. And so, and there's nothing about this. If I turn my wants and my gets over to the care of infinite power and love, then there's a spiritual economy that ought to be in balance. I ought to either get what I want or want what I get. And it's been my experience that that's true. That it's only when I don't get what I think I want that I still think I want what I don't get. And there are two implications of that decision. If I think about that long enough, there's a personal implication and then there's an ethical implication. And the personal implication of the third step is, if I've made a decision to turn what I want and what I get over to the care of infinite power and love, then I ought to be satisfied under all circumstances. And the ethical implication is, if I've made a decision to turn my wants and my gets over to the care of infinite power and love, then I ought to be capable of being loving under all circumstances. And yet I made this decision, read the prayer on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the company of another person, and I've got the date in my original Big Book, the date and the name in the margin. So I know I took the third step because I can tell you the day and the person with whom I took it. But I was still unsatisfied, even in good times, and generally unloving even when I got my way, and I was asking why it's not working. And the answer to why it's not working is contained in something I call the AA waltz. I'm sure you don't have anybody over in Mississippi that does this, but in Harris County we have some drunks that you can go to the old club maybe once every 2 years or so and you run into the same people, and they always have 6 months. Been there forever, but they always have 6 months. And you ask them what step they're on, and they always say step three. And what they're doing is the AA waltz. It goes 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And then, you know, every once in a while they get fancy. They go 1, 2, 3, slip, 1, 2, 3, slide, you know. And you get back on the dance floor and go 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and say, I've made a decision to be satisfied and to be loving, and I'm still unhappy and I'm still unloving. And they said, go home, take inventory and find out. Four step. I need to delve into a little bit of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous to talk about how I take inventory today. I took my first inventory exactly according to the big book, and they told me to make a list of resentments and then look at the fear that was behind the resentment and then look at those situations in which I had been selfish and dishonest. And so, in effect, they told me to inventory resentment, fear, selfishness, and dishonesty. And it's my opinion today that resentment is the name I use for the feeling I have when I am remembering that I did not get my way at some time in the past. Fear is the name I use for the feeling I have when I don't think I'm going to get my way at some time in the future. And selfishness is wanting my way right now. And dishonesty is fear of the truth, that maybe I won't get my way if the truth is known. So All of my defects of character are rooted and grounded in self-will, in the perception that I won't get something I want or won't get to keep something I have. And I found out also that they step where they tell you to take the tenth step, they say continue to watch for resentment, fear, selfishness, and dishonesty. I don't know that they're in that order. Y'all go read the book, find out whether I'm quoting it right. That'll do you more good than listening to me. And in the 11th step, they say, I was going to get to this about when I get to the 11th step, I hope I remember to tell you what I was thinking about telling you just now before I interrupted myself. There's an 11th step inventory that says, were we resentful, fearful, selfish, or dishonest? And so I got the idea I was supposed to watch for those four things: resentment, fear, selfishness, and dishonesty. And I find that when I do it, it works. And when I don't do it, they grow, and I'm becoming resentful, fearful, selfish, and dishonest without knowing it. And yet, when I take an inventory of those four things for a considerable period of time, like 90 days to 6 months, I find that I'm beginning to define my character by those defects of character. Because I'm asking myself, today was I resentful, fearful, selfish, and dishonest? And often the answers are yes, 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 and yes. So if you stop me at random and say, describe yourself, I say, well, resentful, fearful, selfish, and dishonest. And I began to realize I was doing myself no great favor by defining my character through my defects, and I began to look for the positive corresponding principles, virtues, if you will, that corresponded to those four singular defects of character that the big book told me to look for when I took inventory. And I found out that back in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, both Bill and Bob had been exposed to something called the Oxford Groups. And the Oxford Groups were a little group of evangelical Christians who met in private homes and had these small meetings and had these principles they lived by, and they were trying to recapture their concept of first century Christianity. And their primary points of reference were what they called the four absolutes. And the four absolutes were absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. And armed with this little bit of AA history, I went back to that list of resentment, fear, selfishness, and dishonesty, and found out that Bill had simply borrowed those ideas from the Oxford Groups and showed us their other side. He took the four absolutes and showed us the spiritual opposites as being our cardinal defects of character. It didn't take a great deal of intelligence for me to see that honesty corresponded to dishonesty, that unselfishness corresponded to selfishness, that resentment corresponded to love. The two that I couldn't get to connect were purity and fear, and it was because I was operating with a limited definition of purity. Absolute purity would be no more, no less, no different, and no other than mental discipline. The willingness to dismiss when it first appears the false, fearful, selfish, or negative thought. And so with purity so defined I was able to see it as the spiritual opposite of fear and say, oh, I think I'll start taking a positive inventory. I think I'll start asking myself today, am I honest, pure, unselfish, and loving? When I can say yes to those four questions, I've had a good day. And even when I'm forced to say no, there's a certain chemistry or magic about it that begins to create a healing process in the process of being honest about those. And it does two things. One is, in being honest about my dishonesty, I'm becoming honest. And the other is, in becoming honest about my dishonesty, I'm defining my character by those virtues rather than by their corresponding defects of character. The result is that I'm beginning to see my shortcomings as shortcomings, coming short of my ideals, as opposed to unalterable traits of my character which define me as resentful, fearful, selfish, and dishonest. Today I define myself as honest, pure, unselfish, and loving with shortcomings. I no longer define myself as a past master at resentment, fear, selfishness, and dishonesty. And I'm beginning to have a much better opinion of myself and of my fellows in Alcoholics Anonymous when I allow myself to see both myself and others as honest, pure, unselfish, and loving with shortcomings. It helps me take inventory more quickly, too. I don't have to stay up half the night. And I believe it's consistent with the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, if not with the exact wording of the Big Book. I became fascinated with the Oxford groups, and I wondered why we got away from them, and part of the answer has to do with the fact that they were loosely organized in an evangelical mold, and Bill and Bob and some of the guys that got sober were trying to sober up a bunch of drunks in the Cleveland, Akron, and Youngstown area, and they were doing a pretty good job of it, but there was a problem. They kept picking up Roman Catholics. There were just a lot of Irish alcoholics in that area, and then some Poles and some Slovenes and Croats and different kinds of ethnic groups, you know. And these Roman Catholics were saying, guys, we need to do something that, you know, you're reading the wrong Bible. And you got this habit of public confession, and our church doesn't allow it. And God, we need to get sober too. And so they decided maybe we ought to have something just for drunks, and it's a good thing they did. Because Frank Bookman, the founder of the Oxford Groups, was a Lutheran pastor from Missouri, and he was... I'm not going to say anything for which I can get sued. I'll just tell you the historical facts on both sides and let you sort it out for yourself. Frank Bookman was a German by descent, and he made two documented visits to the Reichstag's chancellor between 1936 and 1941. According to the Oxford groups, Pastor Bookman was trying to convert Adolf Hitler. According to their detractors, the Reichstag's chancellor was trying to convert Pastor Bookman. And I won't comment on the truth of the matter, but I will observe that since the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, there have not been many Oxford groups in these United States for some reason beyond my understanding. But it seems to me that sectarian affiliation in religion and political affiliation got them in a lot more trouble than their spiritual principles justified getting into. And if I needed the Oxford groups to sober up, I'd have been in real trouble because there aren't any Oxford groups in Houston, Texas. But I was able to go to the Yellow Pages and find Alcoholics Anonymous. Still had to call Intergroup and get directions to find out where you were. I thought you took anonymity entirely too seriously. I don't know if it's this way in Mississippi, but in Houston, all the clubs are around the corner and behind some tree, and then, you know, if you find the driveway, you might find the club. And in fact, we sold one that had absolutely no possible use except as one of three things. I thought it could be a gaming, a good place for a poker game, might be a good location for an AA club or a house of ill repute. And we sold the property to Catholic Charities, and they made it a home for unwed mothers, so yeah, they found a use for it. Fifth step says simply that I had to confess my defects to God, myself, and to another human being, and once I'd done the fourth step, then doing a confession of sorts with God and myself and another human being was not that difficult, but I did it halfway. I was not able to admit to myself on any level that I found emotionally acceptable, and therefore could not admit to God and another human being the exact nature of my wrongs until I got down to step 7. And yet the fifth step said, the big book said I ought to take the fifth step with someone I trusted, such as, you know, a spiritual advisor. That's the third step. They say wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. And the fifth step, it says I ought to take the step with possibly someone ordained by an established religion, although we often encounter people who might misunderstand. And I knew somebody wouldn't misunderstand because I got turned into AA by someone ordained by an organized religion, so I made an appointment to do my fifth step with my pastor. And then it said I was supposed to tell him what I was about to do and why I had to do it. And I said, well, look, I'm in AA, and I made this decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and then I had to take inventory, and I got to bring it to you. So what I finally accidentally did was that in the process of doing the fifth step halfway the big book way, I accidentally did the third step right, because I shared my decision with my spiritual advisor. So the fifth step was a drunk tramp for people that didn't take the third step right. And then when I got down to step 7, I found out I was going to give God all of me, the good and the bad. And that I wasn't even responsible to sort out which is which, because I was going to give him the whole thing anyway. And when I was able to give God the good and the bad without judging it, then I was able to admit to myself and therefore to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs. So for me, step 7 became a drunk trap for people that didn't take step 5 properly, in exactly the same way that step 5 had been a drunk trap for people that didn't take step 3. And yet one of the first things they told me when I got here was half measures availed us nothing. It's been my experience that half measures availed me something, or I wouldn't be here tonight. But my half measures were big book half measures. And I found in that big book that there were, in fact, drunk traps or safety nets built into the process for the protection of those of us who are educated beyond our abilities and attempting half measures. So I've become convinced that that book was divinely inspired, because I've found the method of recovery that it outlines to work every time. And step 5, for me, step 5 wasn't complete until I did step 7, but that was my experience. And I'm convinced if you're able to take the steps right the first time, you might not have the same experience. But on the other hand, this also has been my experience with people I've sponsored and others. If you just don't take the first drink, certain things will happen sooner or later, the easy way or the hard way, willingly or unwillingly, that you'll look back on and say, that's the process. You see, if I just don't take the first drink, I'm either going to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of a higher power, or I'm going to end up laying there looking at the ceiling and saying, well, whatever. If I just don't take the first drink, I'm either going to take my inventory willingly or circumstances will take it for me and force me to face those realities that are still unacceptable to me. If I just don't take the first drink, I'm either going to make amends willingly or I'm going to come face to face with a situation in which it becomes unavoidable so to do. And the reason I believe that is that there is a higher power that knows whether or not I'm sincere, and when I'm sincere and he's ready, then it's going to happen, you know. I find it easier to take the steps willingly. I find it easier to take the steps voluntarily. But if you ain't willing, just don't take the first drink. And someday, after about 20 years of sobriety, you'll be an old-timer. You'll be sitting in a chair in an AA club somewhere, and people that think you're wise will be asking you how you stayed sober. And it'll dawn on you that you took the steps. Yeah. Maybe not willingly, but if you just don't take the first drink, I believe you're going to take the steps. Makes it easier to take them voluntarily when you know they're unavoidable. And that's especially true of steps like the fourth step and the ninth step, steps that I did not want to take and was not willing to take. When I got down to 8 and 9, I had two suggestions about this, and the one I'll pass on is the one that worked for me. And how do you make a list of the persons you had harmed when you think you hadn't harmed anybody? And the answer is, for me, make a list of the persons you're afraid to run into. Because if there's somebody I don't want to run into, it's probably because I owe them something, you know. And if I'll just, it also gives me an idea what my perception of harm is. If I'm afraid to run into somebody, that means that either he or I have done harm. And that's why I'm afraid to run into them. Now, not everybody on your eight-step list is going to be on your nine-step list, because there are people I'm afraid to run into that maybe I haven't harmed. And a very, very current and important example would be all the people that are childhood abuse victims. You may be afraid to run into the perpetrator, and it's not because you owe them an amend. But what we're talking about in steps 8 and 9 is a liberating process. What we're talking about in steps 8 and 9 is my freedom to walk down any street anywhere in the world not fearing to run into any human being. We're talking about my freedom to go anywhere I want to go and do anything I want to do because I'm a sober, responsible, and self-respecting individual. We're talking about my freedom to go to my family of origin on holidays and not feel uncomfortable. It has nothing to do with them, it has everything to do with me. And for that reason, I think everybody you're afraid to run into ought to be on your eight-step list. Maybe not all those people need to be on your ninth-step list, but where there's fear in a relationship, there's a need for healing in that relationship. And the amend, if you will, or the correction that has to happen may be just as simple as learning to forgive. Not because they deserve forgiveness, but because you deserve freedom. And for me, if you make that list in that eight-step, including anybody you're afraid to run into, then you're going to know those relationships where you perceive harm, and you're going to know those relationships in which healing in some form is necessary, and you're going to know those relationships in which change is possible and desirable. In the ninth step, making direct amends, most of them are simple. If you owe money, pay it. If you don't have it all today, pay it $1 a week, you know. Those are the easy ones. The ones I had difficulty with are the immeasurable ones, like where I had done emotional harm. And how do you make amends where you've done emotional harm, especially if it's something as simple as I was 19 years old and incapable by virtue of age and alcoholism of being emotionally supportive. I think you treat people differently in similar situations, especially if you have the opportunity to treat the same people differently in similar situations. But if you don't have them around, you can't do that, then treat different people in similar situations differently than you treated the people you harmed before. And then there's a certain category of impossible amend that I think can be made in a way. I believe if they're dead, you can pray for the dead. I have an attitude towards praying for the dead that it's like chicken soup. It might not help, but it can't hurt. And to me, it makes a lot more sense than writing them a letter or putting Oreo cookies at somebody's gravesite. You know, if you go out and put Oreo cookies at somebody's gravesite, the only ones going to benefit are the ants. And so I believe you can make amends to the dead by praying for them. And then I have the one I really do not like yet is the one I call the unknown amend. And it's based on the notion that nature always balances the books, but not always by the end of the month. And what this refers to is the situation in which something happens to me in which I seem to be an innocent victim of circumstances. And I am angry, I am resentful, and I am self-pitying until I realize that what just happened to me is strangely similar to something I'd done to somebody at some time that I don't remember. And the best example would be a parked car. Friends, it chaps my ass when a drunk hits my car. And when I go out in the parking lot of the International House of Pancakes and some self-centered, inconsiderate, probably drunken son of a bitch has hit my car, I'm mad until I remember that I used to have one of those rainbow bumpers that had every color of automotive paint in circulation in America, and you could find it on my front right bumper. And I have no earthly idea how many parked cars the universe owes me before we're even. And so when things happen to me that seem grossly unfair and call into question my confidence in my higher power and his protection and care and all that, I think maybe this is one of those unknown amends. You know, maybe this is nature balancing the books. Step 10 suggests we continue to take inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And I've come to believe that that's one of the most important parts of my recovery today, because when I do it, I'm well, and when I don't, I'm not well. And I have allowed myself in recovery to become lax about taking the 10th step and casual about it, and all I became was suicidal, planning to kill myself, you know. But a conference committee in Tampa had already sent me a round-trip ticket, and it was non-refundable. So out of consideration for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I decided not to kill myself until after the conference. Went down to Tampa in a suicidal mood, you know, because they wanted what I had. And heard Charlie P. give a workshop on the fourth step, and as a result of his workshop on the fourth step, I got back to doing my tenth step, and I got back to doing my tenth step within 30 days, none of the circumstances and all of the feelings had changed, and I no longer wanted to kill myself, and I was again grateful to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. It suggests that... And there are some interesting suggestions in the big book about how to go about this and all, and that's where I'm going to get back to my ism. My habitual way of thinking is my alcoholism. My habitual way of thinking is that set of assumptions that governs thought and action that for me inevitably leads back, the superstition leads back to the magic, the alcoholism leads back to the alcohol, and that's my habitual frame of reference. And so the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is very specific about how to meditate and when to meditate, and it says, upon awakening, we think about the 24 hours ahead. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. And the reason I ask God to direct my thinking, the reason I got to do it upon awakening, is that if I allow myself to go to the John before I ask God to direct my thinking, by the time I come out, I'm thinking. But I haven't asked for any direction, so if I then go downstairs and make coffee, and I'm going to wait until I drink that coffee before I ask God to direct my thinking, well, the coffee's making, I'm thinking. And then by the time I ask my God to direct my thinking, I've already been thinking for too long to ask Him to direct it, because I've been thinking from my habitual frame of reference, which is my alcoholism, which is the system of thought and action which controls my disease. And so I ask God to direct my thinking, because if God doesn't direct my thinking, my alcoholism will direct my thinking, and those are my only two possible points of reference. I'm either in the disease or in recovery. And I'm only in recovery when I ask God to direct my thinking. And so the big book is very specific. Before you start thinking, ask God to direct your thinking. And then you can think. The book says God gave us brains for a reason. Sometimes I think I'm supposed to take mine out and examine it and play with it and, you know, try to come to conclusions about what makes it work and who made me do what I just did, you know. But God gave us brains for a reason, and as far as I'm concerned, self-analysis is not the reason. But if I'll ask God to direct my thinking, then for me, I keep it simple. I say, God, direct my thinking by the principles of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. Thy will be done. Amen. And I can say that before I go to the John when I get up in the morning. And then if I'll think the rest of that day on the basis of those principles, my thoughts govern my actions, and my actions turn out okay. But when I relapse into my habitual pattern of thought and action, I'm in disease, and I just by grace have not picked up the drink. But I certainly have wasted a bunch of time chasing my tail and sometimes catching up to it. You know. I really think that I'm going to make my next $1 million selling clear plastic navels that can be transplanted onto alcoholics so that we can see where we're going with our head up our ass. In the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. And I came to you people and had a spiritual awakening. And I had a spiritual awakening, which was an awakening in exactly the same sense that when I open my eyes in the morning and see the ceiling, it is not as if the ceiling was not there while I was asleep. It's simply that I have again opened my eyes to the reality of my ceiling. And when I had an awakening as a result of these steps, it was an awakening of the same quality of recovered awareness of a pre-existing truth. And what it boils down to is when I accepted the disease concept of alcoholism and the spiritual program for recovery that was suggested to me in these rooms, I came to an awakening to a sense of self-worth as a human being and child of God made in the divine image. and not obliged to apologize to anybody for my own 2 square feet of space. And it just so happens for me that the spiritual awakening and the message are one and the same. The message I have for the next alcoholic is simple. You're not drunk. You're not worthless. You're sick. But for that, there is a solution. And when I carry that message, it never fails to reinforce my sobriety, whether a drunk can hear it or not. Because it seems like I always hear my own message, and then sometimes by grace, that drunk can hear it as well. Because I think all of us get here feeling worthless. And most of us get here with a track record that would support that conclusion. And the very first thing they told me was I wasn't worthless. I had a disease. And for that, they said there was a solution. And when I came to believe that my alcoholism was a disease and not a disgrace, and that you had a solution that was guaranteed because the 12th step said, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and the big book said, the promises will always materialize if we work for them. When I came to believe that I had a disease and you had a solution, I came to an awakening, to a sense of self-worth. That's the message I can carry to the next alcoholic. Trouble with a spiritual awakening is I've already defined my disease for you as being a spiritual hunger. And a spiritual awakening is the quality of spiritual experience which will satisfy and gratify that spiritual hunger. And when I'm in fit spiritual condition, I don't even think about alcohol. When I'm in fit spiritual condition, I do not entertain the illusion that alcohol or any other substitute for spiritual experience will make me well. Nor do I need it. When I am whole and at peace with myself, I need nothing to make me whole and at peace with myself. But the trouble with a spiritual awakening is it's like a baked potato. If I'm hungry today, it makes a rat's ass less to me to remember that last week I had a baked potato. And maybe it had sour cream and chives and bacon and cheese and, you know, maybe even a little barbecue in Texas. I may have had a wonderful baked potato last Thursday, but today's spiritual hunger is not gratified by the remembrance of last week's baked potato. And I have to feed that every day. I have to keep that awakening fresh, and I have to keep that awakening in renewal in order to keep that feeling of wellness. And I think that's why I'm told to take inventory, is to remove from my thinking those things that keep me from appreciating the reality of God's love and power. I think that's why I'm told to continue to pray and meditate, is to maintain contact with the higher power that has restored me to sanity and will restore me to sanity and does restore me to sanity, but only when I recognize my insanity and my need for that higher power. And I think that's why I have to continue to carry a message to alcoholics. Besides the unselfish motive, which in my case is frequently the last motive on the list, there's the simple reality that sometimes I forget. I forget that I'm an alcoholic. I forget the nature of my disease. I forget the blessing of sobriety. I get to sitting around having the problems of prosperity. You know, the well people that I associate with today won't do things my way. The job I have today doesn't provide as much money as I think I need. The car I have today isn't as big as the car I wish I had, although I couldn't afford it if I had it. The house I have today protects me from rain, snow, sleet, hail, and is air-conditioned and heat, you know, so it protects me from both heat and cold, depending on which I want to be protected from. But it's not what I wish I had. And sometimes I'm sober and I'm feeling sorry for myself because it seems like I'm getting a raw deal from the world, and so I'll go out and work with a drunk. And what I remember when I work with a drunk is that I need to be grateful for bladder control. You know, I was the kind of guy, when I got here, I'd become a chronic bedwetter. When I go out and work with a drunk, I have to remember that projectile vomiting is not a sign of spiritual recovery. When I go out and work with a drunk, I remember that when I came to you people in January 1976, a day without blurred vision, memory loss, excruciating headaches, and some form of a total lack of control of my bodily fluids, one day without those things occurring was more than I could accomplish on the basis of my unaided will. And one day without those things occurring was all I was seeking when I came to you people in January 1976. You know? And the longer I'm sober, the more likely it is that I will forget. And a philosopher named George Santana once made a very wise statement. He said, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. And if I forget my alcoholism and its consequences, I'll be reminded by my alcoholism and I'll revisit those consequences. But it seems to me that if I continue to work with others, and particularly if I continue to work with people in the active throes of their disease, then I'm not allowed not to be grateful for my sobriety. If I continue to work with others and I continue to see alcoholism in full bloom, I'm not allowed not to go to bed at night and thank God for the simple fact that I have a message for those capable of hearing it. I resent the notion that I'm supposed to share this only with alcoholics. It seems like if this thing is really as good and honest and pure and spiritual as I think it is, I ought to be able to share it with everyone. And there is a sense in which we have, because we've shared our 12 steps with other fellowships. But the reason I'm supposed to carry my message to alcoholics is that only those who have the problem need the solution. I could have learned the 12 steps from an Al-Anon, but I didn't have their problem. I could have learned the 12 steps from a compulsive overeater, but I didn't have their problem. I could have. There are even meetings in California now for people that are addicted to meetings. It's called Addictive Organizations Anonymous. And they have meetings for people that go to too many meetings. And I don't know, but I would guess one of their slogans is, you know, don't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. But it was because I had the problem that I could identify with a solution, and so that for me is the reason I'm supposed to carry my message to alcoholics, is that only those who have the problem can hear the solution. And to practice these principles in all my affairs, and then I'll bring you a little bit up to date on a person who only a few years ago was suicidal in sobriety. Today I have hope that I can make a better life for myself and for my new bride. And today I've gone from a relationship which was a relationship based on fear and perceived need into a relationship which is based on something I really don't understand. Been running into this beautiful lady for years, and when we first started meeting and neither one of us was available, and we met in places we weren't supposed to be at times when we weren't supposed to be there, and there we were, you know, and we kept running into each other over a period of time. And this sounds like a terrible 13-step story, you know. Linda had a year back in recovery in January, and I started dating her in February and proposed to her in March, and we're together. And boy, that sounds like one of those old boys been sober 19 years, don't have sense enough not to hit on the newcomers. But I found out how long we'd known each other and how well we'd known each other when we told her daughter, and I got to hear this adult woman say that she'd heard about me since she was 7 years old. And that helped put it all in perspective, you know. And today I'm beginning again to build what I believe an alcoholic can have. I believe an alcoholic can have a healthy, mutually supportive, loving relationship. But I believe that before we get there, we have to learn to be totally at peace with ourselves. And we may have to burn some bridges to get free of those destructive but habitual relationships that we used to have. And I'm at a point today of beginning again, and I'm beginning again by the grace of God, sober in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to bore you for 2 more minutes. Probably I'm scaring the devil out of the tapers. But I'm going to bore you for 2 more minutes because I always like to touch on a couple of the traditions in closing. And one I just love is the second tradition. The traditions are those which keep us from becoming like the Oxford groups, ghosts on the horizon of history. And the traditions protect us from our alcoholic egos. The traditions are those principles which organize or disorganize Alcoholics Anonymous into independent groups that avoid other affiliations and problems of property, money, and prestige. And the traditions are only important because I want this fellowship to be here for future generations with the simplicity and integrity which it had when I got here in January 1976. But one of the traditions I dearly love is the second tradition, and there are a number of reasons I love it. One is it proves to me that we're all alcoholics. It proves to me that I joined the right outfit because the short form is longer by a full sentence than the long form. Which proves to me that it was written by a drunk. Because, you know, normal people would call the longer one the long form and the shorter one the short form, but we call the long one the short form and the short one the long form. But it says that a loving God may speak to us through our group conscience, and that our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Second tradition gives me a way of getting in 1 hour of meditation even on a bad day. If meditation is listening to God, friends, I have days when if the phone was ringing and I knew it was God, I would not answer because I'm pretty sure I don't want to hear what I think He's going to say. And how do you listen to God when you're in a mood like that? And the answer is go to a meeting. Because a loving God may speak to me through the group conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous, which usually means there's going to be a wino in the room who's going to hit me dead between the eyes with exactly what I need to hear. And so going to meetings willing to listen is one way of getting in an hour of prayer and meditation even on a bad day. But the other thing I like about the second tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous is that when I remember that a loving God may speak to me through the group conscience of this fellowship, and the theme of this conference has to do with the strength of the fellowship. And when I remember that a loving God may speak to me through the strength of this fellowship, it reminds me that it is because a loving God works through people like you that this hopeless, helpless alcoholic is sober tonight. And for that, I thank you.